the cat was crawling out of his bedroom with his stomach on the floor. It looked like the cat hadn't eaten for a few days. Junlin's cat is like his baby. He wouldn't have left his cat unattended for a couple of days. So I called the police immediately. They say, well, stay where you are. We need to talk to you. Then I started to feel things were going on.
Pieces started falling together now, and they both walk in, and they both seem like very happy at that moment. But later on, only one person leaves the building, and he's wearing the same yellow t-shirt that Junlin was wearing before. He stops and he looks at himself in the mirror. It looks as if he doesn't have a worry in the world. He's got a bag in his hand. We're presuming that he was buying plastic gloves and other articles to clean up at the crime scene.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavior analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds.
Our last season is airing right now. I hope you guys are enjoying it and savoring every last wheels up.
It will be a thrill ride. This season is pretty action-packed. There's a lot going on, and we're so excited about it. We can't wait for everybody to see it.
But for now, what are we talking about? Yeah.
So moving on with our continuing discussion about Don't Fuck With Cats.
So back to what we see on Don't Fuck With Cats then. I think it's quite interesting how the body is found, or parts of the body. And quite a lot was found, actually, by the janitor. From a wine bottle, the yellow t-shirt, the puppy, a blanket, papers and a driving license from Ontario, receipts and invoices with the killer's address and his name.
And the poster.
And the poster.
Yeah.
So why go to the trouble of throwing everything in the garbage if you're not really getting rid of anything?
Okay, so here's the thing. This is the difference between somebody who might be smart and somebody who is criminally sophisticated, and somebody who is forensically sophisticated. So he apparently spent a great deal of time cleaning up his apartment. But to him, putting something in the trash made it disappear. It's just not true. Putting something in a suitcase that is human and decaying, you're not thinking beyond this thing is going to rot, decay, and there's going to be a lot of smell, and there's going to be things oozing out of it. And this is, I'm sorry for being graphic, but this is something that happens when human beings die. And so this is not something he thought about. However, he also thought he was too smart, and he planned to be gone. So he thought, that's it. I'm wiping my hands of it, and that's all I have to do. So it was foolish. It was also sort of a snuff to the world. And he knew that there were internet sleuths coming after him. He didn't care. And he knew that law enforcement was going to come after him. And he didn't care either, because he was planning on leaving the country.
Yeah, I think it's another clear trait. I mean, it points to either a form of mental disorder or clear psychopathy of being in the here and now and dealing with the here and now, but being hopeless around strategy, the long-term stuff. And that's what we see a lot. It's these types of things that normally get someone caught, the reckless behavior. But I do think it was interesting that the police originally thought that he must be the victim. And so they treated it as if he were the victim and didn't consider the fact that that might be the perpetrator. And therefore, right, I think quite a lot of evidence was lost. They didn't retain it. And I think that's another, clear learning point for police departments that when you find a body, you collect and you keep and you preserve and you have a clear chain of command. Every evidential piece needs to be bagged and sealed, and you have to have an open mind about this could be the victim or it could be the offender.
Right.
And what about when he mails some of the body parts of the victim to different places? I mean, he's already videotaped himself doing the killing, and now he's taking this extra step for attention to mail these things.
Blood-soaked boxes.
Just like above and beyond.
A foot in pink silk paper.
He's an overachiever in the horror department.
Shock value.
That's what he's
looking for. He's looking for shock value. He's looking to make a statement. He's looking to become infamous. And again, when we talked earlier about when he came in and said, people, it's ruining my life because people are associating me with this Carl Homolka serial killer, and it's ruining my life. I'm being destroyed. It's terrible. Poor me. Pity me. At that time, was trying to be associated with somebody who was infamous. To him, as a child, he liked particular movies about killers. He looked up to them. He fancied himself a great actor. He fancied himself a model. All these things were in his own mind. He manipulated his own looks with plastic surgery. He tried to be some strikingly handsome guy. And to me, he failed miserably.
He did. And just thinking about where he sent those packages, the HQ of the Comm Party to the Prime Minister's office, and it was a secretary that opened the blood-soaked box and found a left foot in pink silk paper. And why I describe that is because it's carefully done, and it is for attention, with a note, roses are red, violets are blue, you'll need dental records to identify you, bitch. So he's very clearly, taunting and trying to seek attention. But the other package went to the Liberal Party. So he's making very clear statements. It's all about attention. So it very clearly is his MO, and he's trying to get that attention. And he thinks if he disappears, he can continue on the journey. But he certainly hasn't thought things through.
No, he does. He has a very shallow knowledge of what is going to happen. And it will eventually come to roost. I mean, he will be caught, and he will be caught very quickly.
When he posts those packages, there were cameras there. So all the police had to do was go to the post office and trace the time those packages were sent. And he was on camera, the same guy on camera with two packages. So actually, it didn't take too long to be able to identify him. We then get another introduction at this point on the documentary, the docuseries. We get a trace to the mother.
And yes.
The mother's address, Anna Yurkin. And we've had a lot of reaction to the mother, Anna Yurkin, appearing on the documentary.
So, as far as this documentary goes, she displays absolutely no empathy or sympathy for any of the victims. You know, never the cats, the human, nothing. She just absolutely is not. I was just stunned by how she sort of says, oh, well, the cats, it's all these PETA activists made such a fuss, as though you have to be an activist to not find what he did horrific. She just seemed to give him every excuse in the world and didn't care of what he had done to June Lynn. I have absolutely no sympathy for her.
Well, I thought she was being sort of the overprotective mother, and she's always going to believe the best about her kid, and she's going to protect him in whatever he chooses to do and buy into any story he gives her and so on and so forth. And I think those things are what we call facilitating, and that is unfortunately something that probably empowered him to do bad things when he was a kid, and to continue to do those bad things as he became an adult.
Yeah, I mean, the certainly the first question to her where they talk about the cat video, she certainly doesn't seem to be shocked or alarmed that her darling son has tortured some kittens to death. Therefore, she must have known about it beforehand.
Yeah.
I thought that was very strange, as, you know, what was going on behind the scenes, and how did they set up the documentary, you know, of talking to her? Because I believe that was her only interview, actually. So it's a real get for the documentarians. I think she had just written a book and Mark Lewis just said it was the right time. But I just wonder how they introduced having the conversation with her. But one thing that just struck me was not looking at her, but looking at one of the pictures that was up on the wall. Mm. And that picture of him and her together, it really had an impression on me, with his arm across her body and his hand around her face, kind of pulling the face to the camera. And I felt she looked fearful.
Mm.
It was a very odd family portrait. You know, when you have a picture taken with your mother or your father, you know, who grabs the parent's face?
A little control in that pose, well, Laura?
I did feel that there was control there. And, you know, sometimes when we hear someone talking, of course, you know, she did, I agree, Lisa, seemed to lack compassion or empathy or any concern for anybody else. And she seemed to have this very clear defensive mechanism. But I felt that there was fear resonating underneath that. I felt that it was all over her face, actually. And the other question that I had is, where's Dad? You know, because we always go to, here's the mother, and, oh, isn't she awful? And why did she do this? And why did she do that? But where's Dad?
Well, from what I know, that they weren't close. They were estranged for most of his life. But his dad did testify at his trial eventually in his defense.
For who? In his defense.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Lin talks about this in his victim statement, that he didn't hold the parents responsible. He held the offender responsible. And he actually, in a way, forgave the father, the offender's father, because he understood he wanted to defend his son, you know.
Of course.
And well, we hear what the psychiatrist said, because I think the psychiatrist, Dr. Joel Watts, really did paint a picture of his lifestyle. But the point I'm making about Dad mm-hmm. is that when dads are absent, we're all very quick to judge the mother mm-hmm. as if she has sole responsibility for bringing a child into the world. And I think it is a very interesting thing, because I've seen it, women are to blame for men's violence. And I really think that has to stop. You know, as I did learn, Donald Newman was his dad. They were teenage parents, apparently, and he mm-hmm. was an alcoholic schizophrenic. And he, after a number of years, became distant and actually wasn't present within the children's upbringing. And again, it's not excusing anything. It's just the fact he wasn't around and he had schizophrenia. And we'll come on and talk about the killer and his diagnosis by this psychiatrist. But I think at least the mother did have the cojones to talk on camera, whereas the dad was absent. And I think that speaks volumes as well. So I wasn't quick I did write notes about the mum, all the things that you said, Lisa, actually, mm-hmm. you know, lacks compassion, lacks empathy, what's going on. And then I saw that picture and I was just captivated by the picture. I actually took a picture of the picture to analyze it.
To actually look at it in detail.
Yeah.
You know what else is interesting about that family is that she apparently brought in a stepfather into the picture who was abusive to the offender. And so he spent his most of his years growing up with his grandparents, who homeschooled him, which I thought was interesting. And I didn't know if that would have contributed in some way to his isolation and I don't know, not feeling.
Yeah, well, the grandmother was very, she was an authoritarian, very disciplinarian, and she beat him too. Mm. So the stepfather beat him and psychologically abused him, and I think introduced him to bestiality.
Oh, God.
Yeah, which that. Is why I was going to talk about the psychiatrist later on, because I think Jun Lin's family, when they got an understanding of the life that he had led, because they have empathy and a big heart, they realized what a sad and miserable life the killer had led. Now, of course, for me, it's always about the psychological autopsy to understand what are the lessons. It's not to excuse
exactly
what's gone on, but we have to understand where someone's come from in terms of the decisions that they take. And this kid was parceled around. The mother apparently did have OCD, and she was a cleaning obsession and would wear rubber gloves all the time and not want to touch the children. And Dad obviously disappeared as an alcoholic schizophrenic, and the killer actually was diagnosed with schizophrenia at a young age and went to the grandmother's, where he was abused and beaten there. So yes, all these things, Lisa, absolutely play a part. You know, obviously we've got the biology, the genes, but then the psycho sexual, social development, the environment that somebody's in, is really important to understand as well.
But also the choices that he makes along the road. I mean, because you can find those things out about yourself and understand those things about yourself, and you can get treatment, or you can reject that and embrace the dark side. And those are human choices that you make in the privacy of your own brain most of the time. And sometimes that leads you down a path that ends up with this kind of extreme, horrific, inhuman behavior. And so it doesn't take away, I think, as you said, Laura, it doesn't take away the responsibility for what he did. It may explain how that path was taken, but it certainly is his choice to do these things, his choice to target vulnerable animals and vulnerable humans.
And then you wonder, did I push too hard? You know, did I not do enough? Did I not do enough? Oh, honey, you did enough. Like, did you do too much? Did you egg him on and give him the attention he wanted, and it was like a drug? It just stopped being enough for him. Did he need more attention? You go through the spectrum of blame. Blaming yourself. And it makes you sick, and your stomach hurts, and you're throwing up, and you're not eating. So I needed to go off grid.
And I think at this point, Deanna, she goes offline. We hear from her, and I think that this was very insightful, actually. You know, did I do too much? Did I play a role? Did I give him the attention that he was craving? And I think that was a very human response, you know, when we hear from Deanna about her feeling guilt about and the introspection that went with that and the real honesty. I think that's a female trait. You know, we hear it from John later on. And of course, the very last part of the documentary, there's some very, I think, critical questions that she poses and breaks the fourth wall, which we don't normally see in documentaries, but
right. She
cut out at that point. I guess what I wrote down about that was, she said, later, guys, I'm done for now. And I wrote, yeah, imagine if you're dealing with this stuff day and night, like law enforcement have to do, where you can't cut out. Because that's right. The reality, isn't it?
That's your job, yes. It's interesting, Laura, and I know you've gotten the question, and I've gotten the question thousands of times, how do you do this every day? How do you do this for years? And you know, we always answer, well, look, it's because we focus on the victims. The victims are our clients. The victims are the ones that are motivating us. And the help that we're able to give them is what gets us through the horrible things. And unless you really dedicate yourself, it does hurt you. And even if you do dedicate yourself, it can hurt you. And one of the things that I do when I speak to law enforcement across the country, I always end with some slides about what happened to me health-wise, because 10 months after I was retired from the FBI, I had a massive heart attack and cardiac arrest, and I am lucky to be alive. Before that, 5 years, I had cancer, and you know, we believe that was a direct result of working on 9/11 at the World Trade Center, and a whole bunch of my colleagues also had the same form of cancer. And those are things that risks that we take because we're on that front line, and we do it willingly. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't make it. And I think it's important that people out there understand that that is a sacrifice, and it is something that weighs on you. And it does affect your personal life, your family life, your friendships, your relationships. It's not something you can quantify. It can be really harmful.
Very true. I mean, I think four of my bosses, senior detectives, all had heart attacks within months of leaving New Scotland Yard.
Wow. See, in New York City, the incidence of officers or detectives retiring and having a heart attack within a year are so high that now their health benefits kick in as if they were still on duty if they have a heart attack within a year of leaving. It's so common.
Wow.
I didn't, you know, Laura, I have to tell you, I thought that, you know, at Scotland Yard and New Scotland Yard, that it was less stressful there because the officers there don't carry guns, that the United Kingdom, even though there's a lot of crime, it's not as violent as the crime here in the United States. We're very violent in this country, and we seem to celebrate that violence, unfortunately. But I always thought that it was less likely to happen. I didn't know that, about that there are so many colleagues of yours that had heart attacks within such a short period of time. But yeah. And so when I talk to these audiences, law enforcement audiences, I always end with those slides. And then I say, you have to find a way to balance. You can't just do this work. You have to find something that's creative, that's an outlet, that relieves stress, that won't continue to allow this to pile up on your life, because it can be fatal.
Yeah. In fact, one of the officers that I worked with, someone called John Sutherland, he went on to write a book after he left. He didn't have a heart attack, but he had a breakdown. And so he now talks about mental health and just how much of an impact when you're policing, and I'll use it in the broader terms, you know, it does have on your mental health, and you really have to look after you. And he's now writing a second book. He's actually on Twitter. I follow him on Twitter. And I think he's very brave, talking very candidly about the impact that the job had on him, and with very serious repercussions. So I think it's a good point to highlight. I know we've talked about it previously, but doing this job, doing it full time, like Deanna could switch it off and walk away from it, but so many people can't do that, the unsung heroes. And because of that vulnerability, no one really wants to talk about it. And that again is when it stacks up even more, because you become isolated in that you can't talk about it, because then you feel vulnerable and weak. But we've got to take care of ourselves. The self-care part is so important. And also take care of each other, our colleagues, when we see that they're struggling, and asking them if they are okay. I think it's really important. It's a slight segue, but a few weeks ago, I learned that someone that I knew here, and I knew him relatively well. I mean, I played ping pong with him, and I'd see him in a group. And, you know, I was told that he took his own life. Oh, geez. And that he just took himself at 5 a.m. in the morning up to Santa Monica and walked into the ocean fully clothed.
Oh, my God.
And I was really just shocked. And, you know, this is somebody who, if you met him, he was very gregarious, the life and soul of the party, young guy, you know, 30-odd years of age. Everybody really liked to be around him because he was so social and so much fun. And trying to piece together what was going on. And, you know, a couple of people knew that he had changed jobs and he wasn't very happy at the job, but they didn't know how unhappy he was. He was very depressed, and actually getting up out of bed every day was obviously a real struggle, but he didn't reach out to anybody. He didn't tell anyone what was really happening, and, you know, called his mother as he was getting out of the ocean and told her that he was having a panic attack. And she thought that she had talked him round and down to feel calm and that he was going to go to work, but he just put the phone down and went back into the ocean.
Wow.
And it really just blew me away, because the facade that he put up was so different to what obviously was really going on. And I think it's a really important point to check on your friends and check on people you know and your colleagues, and really ask them if they are okay.
Yeah. You
know? Wow. Absolutely.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, very, very sad. But I think men in particular don't always talk about the emotional impact of things. And that's why even with Deanna, when we're looking, you know, watching her on the documentary, she's very forthright and very authentic in her sort of anger about what was going on, and about, did she cause it? Was she part of the problem? But she was so honest in that. And women tend to express things much more. And that may be a bit of a sweeping statement, but I think when it comes to emotions, when it comes to difficult stuff, a lot of people do put things in boxes and don't talk about it. And, you know, that's where the warning signs that we may miss when somebody's making out that they're okay, when actually they may well be really struggling.
Right. Well, we can answer Deanna's question. And that answer is no, you didn't participate. You didn't give him the platform that he wanted. You saw what you saw and you acted. You did something about it. And that's the difference between somebody who is voyeuristically, oh, saying they're horrified by it and doing nothing and telling their friends about it, and somebody who actually does something. Mm. I'm going to try to shut this guy down. I'm going to challenge what he has thrown in our faces. And as a result of that, he's caught. And that's a wonderful thing.
The toxicology report of Mr. Lin Han oxapam in his blood. Oxapam is a sedative. Residue that was found in the wine bottle contained the same sedative. So I do hope that Mr. Lin was knocked out.
So it's in this episode that we're introduced to the investigator, Claudette, who I thought was very powerful. And she talks about having to watch the crime in action and that it's the worst thing ever, according to her. And she describes what blood smells like. And I think the way that she does that really, I mean, it took me into crime scenes and made it a very real description. And the detective who broke down crying, saying you can't unsee what you see, that always sticks with me, that human part, the essence of being human. What I wrote about when we see the footage of the killer and Jun Lin going into the apartment, I actually did write they both look very effeminate and gay. And again, because you don't know all these things going into this story, you're trying to join the dots. And I guess the documentarians, they were trying to join the dots as well. But they both looked very effeminate. And that's not anything that's a criticism. It's just, how did he get him in there in the first place? And then we learn all about the Craigslist advert. And I think that was a very interesting setup, because again, it shows that he's preying on vulnerability. But also it's very interesting what Deanna talks about in terms of what we call, Jim, and what Fitz would call the idiolect of the style of writing.
Right. And it's an idiolect is a personal dialect. It's something that is unique to a person. And this is how Jim Fitzgerald was able to identify Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, and a number of other criminals who were trying to disguise themselves and hide behind anonymous communications. Jim is able to unearth some amazing details about how people communicate. And Deanna was able to do it too, which is pretty freaking amazing.
It is. I mean, just looking at style, and she identified, you know, spacing and commas and spelling probably wrong and hot guy, looking at all of his fan member pages, but also looking at this advert. And I think that's a very intelligent and smart thing that she did. But one of the questions that I also had that I thought was kind of weird was that the killer, when he tries to get this puppy, he basically says that his family have this pet store. And that's why he's trying to get this puppy. But I was kind of like, well, if they've got a pet store, why do they need to get a puppy?
I thought it was that he had a pet store when he was a kid. And that, so he's really good at taking care of pets. I thought that's what it was.
I wasn't sure. I just thought it was a very strange thing to say about this pet store, and how did that all fit in? But anyway, he gets the puppy, and unfortunately, Jun Lin also answers the advert. And of course, we know what happens thereafter. We find out that in the closet that there was a note that was written, I think probably by him to himself. And it was, if you don't like the reflection, don't look in the mirror. I don't care.
I thought it was a note to law enforcement. I thought it was a snub to the people that were going to come and investigate this murder. He likes looking in the mirror. You saw him in the lobby of his building stopping to adjust his hair. And we saw that same kind of behavior when he was going through airport security, when he was walking to the post office, whatever. He just does that all the time. It's a very sort of self-centered way of acting. I don't believe he ever met a mirror he didn't like. And I think what he was trying to do was say to people outside that, you do what the hell you want. I'm doing what I want, and I don't care.
So you think it was a note to law enforcement, knowing that they'd go through the door rather than something for him as like an affirmation or something on the wall?
Maybe. That's another take. That's an interesting take on it.
I think he's just trying to be dramatic. And this is what you would see in a movie at this point, where the killer leaves some sort of Nietzsche-esque quote on the door. It just seems so stupid.
Probably. I mean, yeah. It could be that. He is Mr. Drama Queen.
It could well be. I mean, American Psycho obviously features, because it's part of the New Order song at the start, the Bret Easton Ellis, as well as the word bitch. And then, of course, the end that we have is Casablanca. So maybe it is that, Lisa, Casablanca, the movie, in the opening scene, we'll always have Paris.
Oh, God.
Drum roll. Clue so... being left. So perhaps that was part of it. But yes, we've only got through part two of Don't Fuck With Cats, and we've still got the Closing the Net part three to discuss. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
The Case of Sally Challen, The Teacher's Pet, Lynette Dawson, The Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and The Disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website, where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow, on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.